All right, Sam, let's start.
Cool.
So I think Flynn will just join in if he can,
as and
he's on his little bike ride with his mates.
his little fucking bike ride.
fair play, man. Like, I think that's pretty sick. I think it's a really, really cool thing to do. Go for little rides and that.
That is riders.
And I'm sure there's some picturesque scenes on the Barcelona coast that they're probably going down. So imagine that.
Yeah, we'll be sick, to be fair. No wonder he wants to stay out there a little bit longer. Skip the pod.
Anyway, fuck it. Fair play to him. I did that last week, though, to be fair. I was just too busy last week. I just couldn't. There's no way I could find time to do it.
The noose is tightening for me as well. I can barely scrape out an hour. It's becoming challenging.
It is, isn't it? It's you wouldn't think it. Wouldn't think it once a week. It sounds like it's going to be easy. You know what I mean? We do keep up on the scripts almost every week. We've got stuff down on the script, but then it's just actually finding those 2 hours. And I think with the time zone difference as well, that fucking doesn't help at all, does it?
Yeah, all of us in different countries, different time zones, working different jobs in those time zones.
Yeah, I work mainly weekends are my busiest times, and it's like weekdays are your busiest times, and it's just fucking. Absolute nightmare, but here we are. We're here for another episode of the Ball Chat Sports Podcast. Was it episode 69 now?
I believe so, yeah, 69.
Get in there.
Great number.
So, yeah, so how are you doing, Jim? So I haven't seen you in a couple of weeks.
I am okay. The requirements and responsibilities of life are fast taking up every waking moment, but it's been a productive few weeks. The weather here has been scorching these past few days, and the concern for my cauliflowers was undeserved, but the seedlings of the carrots and the kale, they've withered and died, man. They've gone full Mad Max today. That I left them for a few days and they were just choking on dust. So RIP to the carrots and kale. What about you, son?
You weren't down there. You weren't down there watering them.
I should be down there every day when the weather's like this, but it's the same thing we were just talking about. It's just time. So
need to get a sprinkler system set up or something, mate.
Sprinkler system. I don't know, man. That seems a bit high tech for me. I think I should start them in the house and keep a closer eye on them. And then once they've matured, put them in the ground. But it's all learned. It's my first year. How's your club foot?
My club foot, it's getting better, mate. It's getting better. I was out on the, I was down at the Astoria Park, which is just like over the road from Manhattan, basically. You can see Manhattan. And we were doing like summer orientation for the Red Bulls camps that are coming up in the next couple of weeks, which are going to be the most exhausting time of my life, guaranteed. Because I remember doing them in 2018, 2019 with Challenger Sports. By like the fourth or fifth week, you're just like dead on your feet, man. You're out in the sun from like 8 a.m. till 4 p.m. every single day, dealing with like kids that can barely kick a ball, basically, isn't it? So it's just the most exhausting time. So I'm absolutely dreading it in a way. But I'll have a nice tan, innit? I'll have a nice tan from like the neckline to like the t-shirt line, and then I'll just be white everywhere else. That'll just be it. That'll be me in 4 weeks.
I'm rocking a nice little pink tan at the moment because the sun's been out, and I've been out in it from 10 a.m. to like 2 p.m. every day, and I don't do well in the sun. So the top of my head now is quite sore, as is the back of my neck, and it's going to be another scorcher tomorrow. So I can't even put sun cream on because obviously it would drip down into my eyes, and then that's just blinking sweaty sun cream onto people's letters and packages. It's not a good look. So I'm just gonna have to deal with the old lobster look for a couple of days, to be honest.
Oh, we all get that, man. We all get that from Brum, innit? We've got sort of Irish blood in us. So we're just always gonna have that sort of going pink for a little bit, and then maybe it turns brown for like a week or two, then it's straight back to white, isn't it? And like by the time it hits around to like September. But yeah, let's go over the episode summary. So we are going to kick off with England's abject performance in the UEFA Nations League. It was kind of, I wrote this in the script 2 weeks ago, after the first game, I think it was. And it was kind of like, oh yeah, I'm sure it'll improve. And it's just got great, well, not even gradually worse. It's just literally fell off a cliff, hasn't it? England's performances. So, you know, there's a lot of question marks surrounding Southgate. So we'll have a little chat about that. We'll talk about the Birmingham City takeover latest because we don't talk about Blues enough. And, you know, I've been doing a little bit of research on the sort of the happenings in that department. Lawrence Bissini is supposedly on the verge of taking over the club. So we'll talk about him a little bit. And he's been on TalkSport today with some pretty interesting comments. We'll also go over LIV Golf. Shame Tommy Howes isn't here. I think he's just finishing up his holiday over in Cyprus. Yet another holiday. I feel like he's on a holiday every every fortnight, man. Must be absolutely raking in.
He's got two homes. Tommy has the Land Baron, the Slumlord. That's him, isn't it? A week in Madagascar, a fortnight in Antarctica. He's all around the world. But yeah, I think this would be perfect for Tommy. Hopefully we can get him back on soon, especially for Jags news, you know, because I don't think we'll have that this week.
No, we'll see if Flynn gets back from his bike journey and see if he can quickly fill us in on the Jag news. So we're also going to have plenty of actions review over the past 2 weeks. We might gloss over what happened 2 weeks ago because we have had a bit of a period where we didn't manage to get one in last week. So, but we'll mainly focus on UFC 275, was it, this weekend? Great card. So there was some kind of questionable decisions and also some great performances. So we'll chat about those. So I tell you what, we'll skip the preamble ramble for today and we'll go straight into England's performance in the UEFA Nations League. So, you know, we have to talk about it. Like, and you might be laughing, but this is no laughing matter, Jim. Worst home defeat yesterday for 90 odd years, I think it was, since 1928. I don't know who that was. I think it was against Scotland, I read somewhere. I think it was, we lost 5-1 against Scotland.
That's what they said. I watched the highlights about 2 hours ago and I wasn't even aware of the result until I got to work this morning and they announced it on the radio. And I was thinking, how has that happened, man? It's a similar rate of decline that we've seen from Italy. Like, how do they go from winning the Euros last year to being semi-terrible? And how did England go from reaching the final and boxing off defensive masterclasses against top teams and now conceding 4 against Hungary at home? It doesn't make any sense.
Well, I think if we reflect back to the games that we had in the Euros, I think bar the Germany game where we were probably the better team and we ended up, you know, finishing 2 goals. But I remember throughout those games, I was thinking, yeah, we were defensively solid. You know, we didn't really concede many goals. I think Pickford was good in goal during that whole tournament. And I remember just thinking, we're only really threatening from set pieces. I do vividly remember that. And I'm not sure, I haven't got the figures to back that up from the Euros, but I do remember us most of the time being threatening from set pieces, mainly corners. And, you know, that's kind of fed into the sort of performances that we've saw in the Nations League over the last week and a half, 2 weeks. It's been sort of we've been very, very, you know, lackluster in with any sort of attacking threat, really. And, you know, we shouldn't really, because we've got some very, very talented players. And, you know, I think he's been criticised, Southgate, for his team selection. He, you know, in his first 2 games. And then, you know, we had that performance against Germany, which was a little bit better. I think the second half, we were pretty good. I think potentially we were lucky to get back into it with the penalty decision. Some people say that, all right, yeah, it shouldn't have been a penalty, offside positions, whatever you want to talk about. But yeah, I think there was a case for it. Yeah, it was a case for it, but I think by the law, it was a penalty. But we're talking about Gareth Southgate and his team selection. I think he sort of listened to the masses a little bit. He rotated in with Tammy Abraham. I think that was not against Hungary the game before that. Was that Italy? Was it Italy the third game that he played? I think it was Hungary. They lost 1-0. Then it was the Germany game, wasn't it? 1-1. Italy was 0-0. That was at Molineux, which had no crowd, which was really strange. I still don't know why there was no one there. There was only 2,000 school kids or something. And then you had the game against Hungary yesterday, which obviously ended up in a 4-0 drubbing. You know, he's mixed the team around, which is fair enough. You've got 4 games in a short span of time. He probably still wants to test a few players out. You know, Jared Bowen got quite a few minutes. Wasn't that impressed with him, although, you know, we spoke about him deserving a shot. I don't think he was as impressive as I thought he was going to be. He did just look a bit one-dimensional at times. Jack Grealish didn't really get many minutes, not as many as I thought he was going to get. And it comes down to this, you know, his team selection and his tactics and the way he set the team up. And I think against Hungary, a team that you know for a fact are going to sit behind the ball and play a low block, right? They're not going to be a high-pressing team. They're not going to be an ultra-attacking team. So you knew that England had to possess the ball and try and play through the gaps and, you know, split defensive lines and try and work the ball that way. A lot like Man City do. So you know, Man City have got three players in that England team, right? So they've got Phil Foden, Raheem Sterling, and Jack Grealish. Not one of them players started against Hungary. Three players that are part of Pep Guardiola's system, where it's short possession-based football, where you play in tight areas to be able to draw players in and then try and attack the other side, or, you know, try and split defensive lines. And we didn't try and do any of that. It was just so, like, we had the ball, like, for a period of about 2 minutes in the first half yesterday, where we were just basically, like, moving it from left to right in our back line. We got Reece James, who is a right, clearly a very, very one-footed player. Can't really use his left foot. And he was playing left back. So every single time he received the ball, he was receiving it, like, narrow. And, like, he was just cutting off his passing lane. He didn't open his body up. So that was easy for them to defend, because as soon as he got the ball, he had to go back inside. He couldn't go wide because he wasn't receiving on his left foot. Or to be fair to their defenders or their wide players, the way they were defending is that they were forcing him back inside. And it was just so, so mundane and so slow, the build-up. It had no creativity about it. That, you know, and we've got players that are playing, you know, for the highest level, like, you know, all around the world, all around Europe rather. But, you know, it was just really, really disappointing. And then, you know, second half, you know, Guardiola changed it up. He reverted back to, like, his, you know, his 5-3-2. He started off with
Southgate.
He started off with two sixes, you know, with Declan Rice and Calvin Phillips, which is such a negative formation to play against a team that you expect to beat, to play two defensive midfielders, two holding midfielders. And we spoke about this in the chat. I said, you don't need Calvin Phillips in there if you've already got Declan Rice. Play Mason Mount and Jude Bellingham, or, you know, play even, you know, Conor Gallagher was in there, but, like, I didn't see enough of him. And I don't think he's been a, you know, he's sort of like getting a test out. You know, he's not definitely for sure. He's not going to be a solidified place in that team. So he's putting the feelers out on him. But I don't know. There was nothing about it that gave you any kind of confidence going into the World Cup in December.
You mentioned the three Man City players that didn't start. I can understand the degree of rotation on Southgate's part, especially in this competition. But Jack Grealish in particular didn't start many games in the Euros, didn't get that many minutes. He's experienced something similar at Man City. He's gone from playing every single game for Villa, stepping up a level, and he struggled to make the massive impact at City and at England than he did at Villa. Maybe that's an unfair expectation, but why don't you think Southgate and Guardiola prefer to give him more responsibility?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's something that doesn't immediately spring to mind as to why he doesn't get enough chances. And it, you know, he's a high caliber footballer. Like, you wouldn't pay £100 million for a player if you didn't really think, like, he could deliver at the high stage. And I think he can, and he's exciting, and he's a threat. And I think in the way that Hungary play, which was, you know, they were going to sit behind the ball. They weren't going to press us in our own half. They were just going to sit around the halfway line. That's going to be their line of engagement. And then anything that's put into those sort of those spaces in between, you know, the halfway line and sort of the final third, or our final third, like, they were just going to make sure that they stay compact. And we needed players that were confident dribblers. And, you know, we wanted someone like, you know, Saka started the game, but he didn't really get many opportunities to do that. But we needed someone like Grealish to be able to get on the ball and drive at players and commit players. Do you know what I mean? But we just didn't have the opportunities to do that. We weren't putting players into the spaces, getting the ball into feet and being able to play that way. And I was thinking to myself, what was Southgate's game plan? I think I can't remember what it was that he said, but his pre-match comments were just, you read them and you're like, that's got nothing to do with, like, the team that you're playing. You know what I mean? It was like the opposite. What did he say? Here it is. I got it here. He said, the players over the last two games in particular have had really intense tests, and we need to press well tonight. We need to unsettle Hungary, and we have to put energy in, and players who like to do those sorts of things. And it's like, what the fuck does that even
mean?
Convincing.
It's not very convincing, that. But I think a factor here as well is the season has only just finished. I was looking at that England team and thinking, these aren't the players I'm used to seeing play for England, but they play for the top teams in the country. by and large. And they have played an awful lot of football over the last season. So this is why having extra international competitions when the calendar's already rammed is possibly, while commercially a good idea, probably not the best thing for the athletes themselves.
But you can't. We can't use that as a an argument for the poor performances, though, can we? I'm just looking here. Grealish did get the full game against Italy. That's probably the game that I saw the least of. I'm not sure how he did play in that game, but even look at the team there. He played a 4-2-3-1. Kieran Trippier at left back. I don't know why we haven't got any left backs. I don't know. Is Ben Chilwell injured? Who's the other one that played a little bit? Tyreek Mitchell, I think he played in a friendly earlier on in the season. I'm not sure why we didn't select any left backs, but he needs to figure that out before the World Cup. And obviously, you know, the conversations about him getting sacked are premature. Like, he's not going to get sacked over a few poor performances in what essentially are glorified friendlies. But I think this UEFA Nations League is basically going to take away the idea. It has taken away the ideas of friendlies. And we spoke about friendlies, like, we didn't need them. You know what I mean? So this has replaced them. It's a little bit more competitive. So this is something that should be put against your name when it comes to, you know, poor performances. They matter when we're playing teams like this.
You don't think that the long season and the lethargy, you don't think that's a factor at all? Like,
but it is a factor, 100%. But it can't be used as an excuse because the hungry players have gone through exactly the same thing. You can't say that a lot of these hungry players, you know, they've been playing at a high level, a lot of them playing the Bundesliga. So, you know, they've still been playing at like a high level at the same amount of games, the same training regime. So
that's interesting, you know.
I'm just saying we can't use it as an excuse. Do you know what I mean?
No, I understand that. And there is a level of responsibility they have to take. They are full-time athletes who get paid an awful lot of money. I accept that as well. But what you've just said there is quite interesting, that a lot of the hungry players play in top leagues, may it be the Bundesliga or elsewhere around Europe and the world. Could it be that they're a lot better than traditionally Hungary have been, that this current crop of players is actually half decent?
I think so. Yeah. I think there's a couple of names that ring off. I think it's that Saloy who got a couple of goals against us the other night, and he scored, I think, in the first game that we played when we lost 1-0. They got a Szoboszlai. I think he plays for, might be one of the Bayer Leverkusen, I think he might be playing for. But anyway, I don't know who they play for, but I know there's a lot of them that play in the Bundesliga. So they're playing at a high level every single week. And, you know, there's a lot of good coaches over in Germany, as we've seen. You know, and we've spoke about this before. A lot of the, you know, sort of the premium coaches that come over, you know, in Europe, or the highly respected ones, come from Germany. So well-drilled tactically. You know, these players are part of, you know, German setup, German teams and German setups that are very attuned and very, very knowledgeable about the game. It's not like we're playing teams from, you know, that players that play in Estonia or, you know, the sort of European nations where perhaps, you know, the level of coaching and the level of play isn't up to standard. These teams are very, very good. The players are very, very good. So I don't think it's a case of we took them lightly. I just think it's like, we just don't know how to beat teams that low block. And I think that should be something that Gareth Southgate should be looking at and saying, why can't I look at Jurgen Klopp's tactics? Why can't I look at Pep Guardiola's tactics and try and implement that in them within the England squad? Because at the end of the day, we're using the same sort of players, and, you know, we want our players to play the same sort of football. So it's a conundrum for sure, because we can't keep on going like this and expecting to play defensive football and winning by, you know, scoring a set piece and then not conceding, because that game plan has come totally undone over these last four games. So it's a real warning signs, man.
It's a style of play and a mentality that might be better suited to tournament football as well. You know, it's a very, to be fair, I feel like the players who are asked to do that kind of job require a lot of composure to do that. And maybe, I don't know, there could be a lot of factors in it, but they're definitely not on the same level as they were last summer. There are a number of factors for that. A lot of the players that played in these recent games weren't even playing last year. So there is an element of transition about it as well. But if I was a diehard England fan, I would take this last run of results as a little bit concerning, especially when the World Cup's not that far away.
Yeah, and to be honest, we've always been a team that's been better at playing on the break, to be honest. We're more of a counter-attacking team. We haven't really been a great possession team, like, for however many years. I can't remember the last time. You know what I mean? We've been a very good possession team. I think that's why we probably got a positive result against Germany. The Italy one, obviously, I didn't watch much of it, but I saw a little bit to the first half. But as you say, they're another team that's in transition. They got smashed by Germany 5-2 yesterday. So Hungary are top of the group. Germany are up there. Italy have been pretty poor. So yeah, it's a lot of transition, a lot of question marks over Southgate and his tactics. And the big question, you know, realistically, we talk about him managing England, who, you know, it's essentially, it's meant to be the best job in the country. But would Southgate get into any top six? Like, would he get offered a top six job? Like, he wouldn't, would he?
I don't think so. But the England job, in my mind at least, has always been dependent on a certain degree of politicking, for want of a better word. You have to kind of go through the system. You have to be the right candidate for reasons other than football. You know, we saw that with Sam Allardyce, didn't we? I mean, like, people were asking for years, why didn't he get the job? He finally gets it. And then he was involved in that scandal. I can't quite remember the scandal, but he got like one game in charge, didn't he? And it was this...
Was it like a bong or something? I can't remember what it was.
Something like that.
He was sat down at a dinner table and they recorded him saying something like, you know, I don't know if he was taking a bribe or something, or I can't remember what it was exactly. But
something that wasn't that surprising given Sam Allardyce's like general image. But you can't be associated with those kind of things, even on like a low level. You have to be squeaky clean. And I think that's part of the reason why Gareth Southgate is the ideal candidate. But I don't think you can criticise him too hard considering what he did last summer. And I wouldn't be rushing for him to be kicked out of the job just yet. He's been in that system a long time, you know, and I feel like just knowing the day-to-day of the job is valuable in itself, experiencing the position. Like, I think if he's been a little bit less effective on the field, I think he's solidified his position as the manager throughout the last few years, man, for sure.
But I'm unsure about his experience as a coach. That's the only issue, man. Like, yeah, he might be a good manager. Like, he might be good at, you know, being the face of the team. And, you know, he always comes across pretty well in press conferences and stuff. You know, talks well and, you know, raises, you know, issues that are outside of the game as well pretty well and addresses those. And he's done well with that. You know what I mean? I think he's done fantastic in terms of, like, you know, addressing anything to do with the criticism that the black players had for missing penalties and stuff like that. And I think he handled that well. I think he handles the sort of the political side of the game very, very well. But it's his coaching ability. I'm not sure he's got enough coaching ability or experience at a high level to warrant having that job. And, like, international football has become a little bit like that, hasn't it? It's like the best coaches in the world aren't international managers at the minute. You got, like, you know, what's his name? Was it Martinez that was at Everton? You know, he failed there and then he managed to get the Belgian job for however many years. I'm not sure if he's still there now. But, you know, you just see that quite a lot. You see a lot of managers that have failed at club level and that go and get like a really big international job. I think, was it Goose Hiddink and the guys that go and take the Holland job are usually guys that are sort of past it or, you know, have had a bad experience at club level. So, but I mean, I personally, I've been saying it for ages. I'd love to see Jose Mourinho get the England job, but as you say, he doesn't fit the profile that the FA want. You know what I mean? Ultimately, it's the FA. They pick the right man, the right fit. And, you know, I feel like managers like him probably wouldn't take it. Or they wouldn't get it based on the fact that they're just not the right fit.
Yeah, he's too flamboyant, Jose. He'll talk the real. I know you have to have your kid gloves on when you're England manager, and I think he lacks that kind of finesse, even though I'd love to see him in the England job as well, to be fair.
I think he'd be really, really good for the team. I think, you know, he's got a good history of working with young players. I feel like he'd be a fantastic fit, but I think Southgate, 100%, I think you wouldn't want to make any rash judgments. I think he will be there in the World Cup. Almost certain he will be. So we'll see how that goes. I mean, you never know. If he has a poor performance in the World Cup, maybe he gets let go. But then I can see a Scott Parker or an Eddie Howe You know, someone like that would probably get the position, wouldn't it?
You know, say the impossible happened and Mourinho ended up in the job. Do you think that his England team would play football that is that different from what Southgate's teams are currently delivering?
It's a good point. I don't think he'd play. He definitely wouldn't play back five. But I think he would get a different level of intensity out of those players. I believe. I think just by his personality, I think he'd be able to bring that out of it. I'm not sure how Gareth Southgate's very laissez-faire, laid-back personality translates onto the training field. You know what I mean? And how his persona comes across the players. I can't see him being a manager that goes in there and that's like, fucking hell, lads, come on, get your head screwed on. You know what I mean? We need to be better than this. We need to do this. I can't see him having an extensive list of reasons of why we were poor in that first half. And I don't know if he gave them solutions because it just looked like he changed system and expected, I think he made once about halftime. I think he changed system, changed one player and expected things to just like miraculously fix themselves. I'm not sure if he's actively thinking about how to defeat the team and like how to exploit the weaknesses of Hungary. So I'm really unsure about his tactical awareness and his tactical knowledge really and how to apply it against different teams.
Damn, with Southgate then, yeah?
So, hashtag that. I've never liked
Sack him.
Never liked you. All right, well, we'll move on anyway. We'll move on. We'll have a quick talk about Lawrence Pessini and his takeover bid for Birmingham City because he's been on TalkSport today, supposedly to try and put the Birmingham City fans at ease about the potential takeover. And he's come out and said, like, yes, the contracts are basically signed. We're just waiting on the formalities. And I think this guy, Lawrence Pessini, has somewhat of a shady past. I don't think he comes across as being a man held in high regard in the sport, to be honest. I think he was previous manager at Watford for a couple of years. I think he acquired them in 2011, reportedly for £440,000, which is not much for a football club, is it, to be honest? But in 2007, he'd been declared bankrupt. And something that he supposedly blamed on his father. So we're starting to see this sort of personality that is starting to shape and mold about this guy. And then he changed his name to Bazzini, from Bazzini to Bassini to make a fresh start. So this is the kind of guy we're talking about, a man that has to change his last name to try and reinvent himself as a person. But when he was chairman of Watford, Bassini was a subject of allegations of financial impropriety known as the Safegate scandal, which occurred just prior to the sale of the club in June 2012. So as the old Hobo Baggins?
Bilbo, is it?
Bilbo Baggins. As Bilbo Baggins would say in The Lord of the Rings, it's like out of the frying pan into the fire, isn't it? So I'm really, really not sure about this decision. Well, I say it's not really Birmingham City fans' decision, is it? It's just what it is, isn't it? But you know, it's quite worrying that it's not somebody that's going to come in and really sort of like give the Blues fans what they want, which is what they like, safety. Do you know what I mean? They want somebody that's going to come in with a fresh record that's, you know, done it before. But supposedly Sullivan, you know, I think it's Golden Sullivan, West Ham ownership, they have some kind of involvement in it. I think they're financiers and this guy is going to be the sort of like financial front for it. Supposedly he said on TalkSport that there is a female CEO with a lot of experience. That struck me as being Karen Brady. That sounded like Karen Brady when he was describing it. I'm not sure if it will be. I, you know, she was hated when she was a Blues, I think, if I remember correctly. My dad didn't used to like her. I think because she was like a powerful young woman. Like, and you know, 15 years ago, that was kind of like a bit uncomfortable for a lot of men. But I think to be honest, if she did come in, Karen Brady was on the board, I think that'd be fantastic. I really, really do, because they know that at least they know how to run a football club and they're experienced with the club as well. So I think that would be a great plus. So there's some kind of like positives and there's some negatives.
Well, Lawrence Llewellyn Pessini sounded like just the kind of snake oil salesman Blues need to take over.
Throwing a bit of Welsh name in there in the middle, has he?
He said something that piqued my curiosity, and I'm not sure if it's common practice at football clubs. He said they were going to have equally joint chairman. Is that something that teams do a lot? Or
yeah, was it like I said, like two CEOs or something?
Like two joint 50-50 CEOs or chairman, I think you said, which sounded to me like needlessly complicated. But I don't know if other teams do that.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's that uncommon. I know you have these various sort of like different titles like CFO, CEO. I'm not sure how they translate into the sort of football world because, you know, essentially it is a business as well, isn't it? Like chief financial officer or whatever, chief executive officer. I'm not privy to the actual, you know, titles and how they would relate into the running of the club. But, you know, it sounds like he's just like the finance guy and he's been backed by Sullivan. I think it's because you can't legally own two teams. So I feel like this is a bit of a loophole. He's kind of like being fronted as this, you know, what would you call it? A puppet almost.
The fall guy.
Yeah, yeah.
He's the fall guy, man.
And Flynn's joining us now just in time for Jag news after this. But yeah, so I think they're trying to get around it. I think it's kind of a loophole to make sure that he can put the money in. So, I mean, it's positive. I think if they are involved, the Gold, Sullivan and Brady, I think that's a massive positive for Blues. And I think a lot of Blues fans should be like quietly optimistic about the direction of the club. We just need to make sure that we do not get relegated the next season because I think we're in a really precarious position. And I think we just need to make sure that by any means we stay in the league again and then we can hopefully build on some stability that we get. So, but we'll see. I think at least the club's heading in the right direction. Obviously the Chinese owners have took the L and we all, you know, we've spoke about this before about Chinese ownership and sort of the culture in China about saving face and, you know, them not wanting to admit that they got things wrong and, you know, they don't want to, you know, sort of like just drop it and say, all right, we got things wrong. But at the end of the day, like, it wasn't for them, was it? And it's not turned out well. They had this 3-year plan where they wanted to get back at, I think they said Champions League at one point. And you know, can you imagine Blues in the Champions League? No, we can't. So, Flynn, have you had conversations with Conor Flynn about this potential Blues ownership?
Can you guys see me?
I can't see you now.
My video's working, but it's not coming up on this meeting.
Yeah,
for
right,
some reason,
mate.
But... I was hanging out with Conor Flynn on the weekend, actually, and we did talk about it a little bit. But what's the story with this? I'm hearing we're going from one faceless owner to another faceless owner. What's? I'm sure you've probably gone into detail about it already, but if you haven't, what's the story there?
No, it's not really. It's this Lawrence Bassini, who's a bit. He's a shady character, but at least you know like who he is. I think there's the assumption that he's been fronted as the financier person involved in the deal. But I think a lot of the money's supposedly coming from Gold, Sullivan or whoever it is, you know, the owners of West Ham. So they obviously owned Blues. I think how long ago was that now? Was that about 2011? I think when they sold the club, they sold it to the hairdresser. Carson Young, the hairdresser conglomerate, mate. Yeah, made his money in hairdressing chain apparently. But yeah, so they're the ones that sold the club to him. But it sounds like, you know, the CEOs are by what Lawrence Bassini is saying, you know, they're going to instill experienced, you know, directors on the board that have, you know, an experience in the game and doing their jobs. And, you know, it sounds positive. So we're praying that a lot of this is kind of not just bullshit coming from him. So, you know, it could be positive for Blues fans. You never know.
It's not going to be.
Yeah, it's probably going to
end up
horrendous. But we'll move on from that. We're hoping that it doesn't go down the road of what the Derby ownership, because I think that is it Kirshner, the guy that was meant to be taken over there. He's pulled out of that. And then Derby are being now threatening with potentially not being invited or being expelled from the league next year, which is like really, really serious, man. So we're kind of like hoping that that situation gets resolved because they're in a much worse position than Birmingham at the minute. So we're hoping that gets resolved because it'd be terrible to see a club like that. Here we go. We got him now. straight from his bike, not even showered, man. That's, look at that commitment, man. Straight onto the pod.
Good man.
I am hunking, mate. Look at the sweat in my hair, and I still got my gloves on.
Get in there.
So. Awesome ride, though. Awesome ride. It's the best ride I've had in years, I think. Like, I've been off cigarettes long enough now that I think my stamina's back, because I was just flying up the mountain and just not getting out of breath.
Nice.
I think I got the mojo back. Tour de France next year for sure, man.
Oh, yeah, definitely, man. Definitely. 100%. I'll put the house on it, mate. I'll take the deposit from the house and stick it on you. Put it all on Flynn.
Just get me the PEDs. I'm good to go.
Oh, you know it, mate. There's a package on the way.
That's it. Jim will be funding those, man, for sure, man. You know, he can tell you exactly how to use them, man. Best times to use them. Give you a training regime for it, man.
Yeah, EPO at 1 in the morning, HGH at 9 a.m. A couple of anabols at 2 p.m. just to keep you ticking over. Bit of Stanislav at 6 with your porridge.
No, it's just chicken breast and broccoli, I heard. That's all you need.
Definitely, man. I'll send the chickens and the broccoli over to you, mate.
We'll quickly touch on LIV. We'll do the five things and we're straight into the feature fight. So this has been kind of over the last 2 weeks, once again, something that, you know, we wanted to touch on last week before we couldn't get the pod in. But it's kind of developed a lot since then, hasn't it? And we've been sort of chatting a lot about it in the WhatsApp group that we've got. Shame Tommy Hours isn't on as well, because he'd be able to touch on this a little bit more as well. But the LIV Golf basically kicked off last week, LIV London, after sort of weeks of controversy, really, with some popular golfers from the PGA Tour announcing that they would be participating, Dustin Johnson being one of them, and who was number two in the world. And then the PGA last week made their counter move by claiming that any current PGA Tour golfers that become involved with the LIV tournaments would be kicked off the tour. So they're basically saying, like, you know, if you do the dirty on us, then fuck you, kind of thing. So it's becoming a bit of an all-out war. And I imagine for you, James, it's becoming the only time you've had any kind of interest in golf.
Finally becoming interesting for me. But thing is, the golfers give. Oh, you're going to give me 10 times my annual earnings in one shot. Oh, don't kick me off the tour, please. I'll just do two more LIV events to be absolutely set for life, generational wealth. Like, there's no... This is the power of finance. Everyone's got a number. It doesn't matter how long the PGA has been going. If they come in with a high enough offer, they're going to get whoever they want. It's as simple as that, man. And it is a shame Tommy's not here, because he could give us, like... He said in the group chat how long the PGA Tour has been established, and he was quite doubtful of how effective this takeover could be. But, I mean, you get the number two in the world. It's not a bad start, is it, really?
Well, apparently, someone told me they offered Tiger Woods $1 billion, like, to play on it, to play on
that
the...
mental.
It's just, like, absolutely filthy money. And even this Andy Ogletree, who finished dead last in this LIV London, he got 120 grand just for turning up for 3 days, man. That's like, it's like a seventh, eighth place finish, like, in terms of finance for the PGA Tour. Like, to get that amount of money, you'd have to finish high, you know, in the top 10 at least, man. So you can't knock these golfers for wanting to go and do it. They might just go and do it for a year or two, make more money than they have in the last decade. And then, you know, what they're probably thinking is go back to the PGA Tour. But it's unsustainable, man. Surely, like, the Saudis haven't got that much money. But saying that, the price of petrol nowadays, like, they're probably absolutely raking it, man. It's going all straight, all to these golfers, man. That's what all our money that we're spending on this extra fuel is going straight to these guys.
I can't imagine why these players are receiving criticism. And I think there is a high-handedness about the way they're being written about and the way they're being reported on. Do you remember that video that we put in the group chat, and the reporter was asking, I can't remember who it was, but he was basically saying, don't you have any hang-ups about accepting dirty money from a regime that does X, Y, and Z? And I thought, that's a bit rich, mate. Like, you want to be asking Boris and the boys those questions before you ask any professional athletes. Like,
oh, I mean, Pally with the shakes. No one,
yeah, it's like no one's no one's blameless. Like we all kind of let that shit slide because we benefit from it to exactly. various degrees. Like, do you know what I mean? So even the person asking that question would have benefited from that situation. And I think people are using it as an opportunity to say these golfers, they're gaudy, they're greedy, all they care about is money. But it's just a set. It doesn't matter. As long as they're playing against the best, I don't care what brand is on the banner. As long as they're playing each other.
What percentage like of any man or any woman is going to refuse like 6-7 times their annual salary to go and do exactly the same job? Like, what man or woman is going to turn that down based on like very, very small sort of like moral, I don't know, your small moral compass that might be sort of slightly ticking, you know what I mean? Slightly wavering. Do you know what I mean? Because of human rights, the Saudi human rights. What, you're not going to fucking change the world, are you, by refusing what these guys are getting paid? Like, do you know what I mean? Oh, nah, I'm going to take the moral high ground and not accept like an extra $5 million. Like, fuck off. Just, you know, why should these golfers be the guys that like take the hit, take the financial hit?
They shouldn't at all.
Absolutely not. Like, so, you know, and more people go from the PGA Tour, like ask, as you say, put these questions to Boris, man. Put these questions to all the politicians that are doing like dealings with them. If you really want to take it to those levels, man. But don't be a reporter and like these guys that have spent like decades trying to, you know, hone their trade, and when they've got an opportunity to make a lot more money in like one tournament than they have in their whole life, don't like belittle these guys just because they're playing part of a competition, man. It's bullshit.
I hope the Saudis take over more sports, man. To be honest, I hope they get a stranglehold on every profession.
Yeah, the boxers need a bit more money, don't they?
Definitely. I was in the co-op earlier, and I seen the front page of the Sun saying Fury's coming back for $200 million. Show me the money. And I was like, that's not news, man. Like, he doesn't beat your number one contender with ease in front of 90,000 people at Wembley, and you're still in your prime. And there's hundreds of millions on the table. You don't just retire. Like, you can't listen to what he's saying. He's off his head, Fury. Everyone knows he's off his head.
Yeah, yeah. So,
he was why never is this news? Anyway. Why is this front page news?
What a headline. Man likes money.
Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly, man. Exactly. The number's high enough, you'll get what you want. Simple as that. I don't blame Fury for coming back out of his supposed retirement for $200 million. I don't blame any golfer for taking the cash grab at all, man.
And I think it's good for the game as well, isn't it? I think for generating interest in the game, and I think competition is always good for a sport, do you know what I mean? With different organisations. So I think it's only going to be a good thing going forward. And clearly, they won't be able to keep this up, like in terms of how much money they're pumping in. I just don't see how... it doesn't seem like a financial model that's set up for success. So maybe it's a sort of one-and-done season. I don't know how they're going to really sort of embed themselves. And make it sustainable long term.
They're in the scrum right now, aren't they, though? Like, in order for them to muscle in on the establishment, they have to bring something new to the table, which is shitloads of cash.
That's the only way to do it, isn't it? Because they've got no prestige. They've got no, like, you know, it's not like they've built like brand new courses that are fantastic to play on. It's like they're going to use the same sort of courses, aren't they? So, you know, as you say, money's the only way they can tempt over the big names. And people aren't going to, you know, they're not going to get eyes on screens unless, you know, the Tiger Woods of the world are playing. I'm surprised Tiger didn't take that deal, man. $1 billion.
He's probably after $1.3 billion, isn't it? That's probably him and his agent.
Phil Mickelson's only gone over there so he can, like, keep his absolute horrendous gambling addiction. Like do you know what I mean?
You go to the Saudi tour as like a kind of a rehab.
Yeah, literally. We'll probably round that off there. We'll talk about that again next week when we get Tommy Hours on. He'll probably able to tell us some other little facts about it because he's big on his golf. So we'll rattle through the five things, and then we've got the feature fights to finish. So, I mean, these are from a few weeks ago, so it's going to be might be even old news, man. So, Man United scouts flew all the way over to Brazil and ended up being impressed by their own player. So it sums United's transfer policy up, really. They're out in Flamengo to keep tabs on 21-year-old midfielder João Gomes. But sources told ESPN that reports made it back from Brazil highlighted Andres Pereira as the most notable performer. Pereira has impressed during a long loan spell at Flamengo, but a permanent move to Brazil has all but collapsed. He's expected to back at United in the summer with new manager Erik ten Hag, who knows Pereira from their time at PSV, and he's keen to take a close look at the 26-year-old. But this just smacks like Man United transfer policy in it. Oh, yeah, we're out scouting this player that we're about to spend 40 million on. Oh, who's that guy over there? Oh, he's played with us for the last like 6 years, man.
The club is just in an absolute tangle, and that does sum it up. And I'm still not sold on the seventh saviour in as many years at Man United, man. I think there's an awful lot to disentangle there, and that speaks volumes. It doesn't seem like the club is moving as a cohesive unit, does it, at all? Yeah, but I could be wrong. He could come in and the team could start smashing it.
We shit on Man United a lot, but where did they finish? Like fourth in the end?
Sixth, I think.
Oh, was it sixth? Oh, yeah, fuck them then.
Those two places make a big difference now. But I think it's all about like the expectation. United is always high on it, man. Like it's been high for a long time. Like Fergie,
they're dickheads, man. They're absolute dickheads. They're the worst. I think the only other fans that are worse than Man United fans are Arsenal fans, because there are some Arsenal fans that genuinely think Arsenal should be challenging for the title year in, year out. So like, what are you talking? Just shut the fuck up, man. We'll get fourth if we're lucky. Relax yourselves, man. Idiots.
Nonsense. Liverpool and Man City, I can't see how they're not going to finish in like the top two for the next like 5 years, man. Look at the signings they're making, like Haaland for City, then this Darwin Nunes, is it? I think he's from, is it Benfica that Liverpool have just signed? But yeah, they're just constantly signing the best players, isn't it? Like, and it's not like they make bad decisions either. They're making really, really good financial decisions, unlike United. So yeah, number two, Ryan Fitzpatrick retires. One for the Tommy Howler. A 17-year NFL career comes to a close for Fitzmagic, who becomes synonymous with competitive but inconsistent performances for his teams. He came out of Harvard College in 2004 and was drafted by the St. Louis Rams at pick 250 in the seventh round. And then he went on to play for another eight teams, finishing up at the Washington Football Team, or Commanders as they're now known. He holds most career passing yards and passing touchdowns among NFL quarterbacks without postseason appearances. So that tells you all you need to know about Fitz Tragic.
I don't know what's a worse name, the Washington Football Team or Fitz Magic. That is bad, isn't it? Do an edit. Do a second draft.
Whoa, you know. Fitz Magic.
Yeah. I feel like they should have sung that song, man.
That's Fitz Trick, man. Oh my gosh. Yeah. Fitz Magic. That's bad. That is bad.
He was either Fitz Magic or Fitz Tragic because of like, he was just so inconsistent in his performances, isn't it? Like, he'd look like the best quarterback anyone's ever seen one game. And then next game, he'd be like, all right, he throws like five interceptions, man. All right, we're back to where we are. We've got our baseline, Ryan Fitzpatrick.
Did he ever play for the Jags?
I think he might have played for the Jags as well. Yeah, yeah. A little bit of Jag news. Is there any Jag news this week, Flynn?
There is a little bit of Jag news. I've slipped a little bit in there.
We'll do it before the feature fights then. All right. So, number three, Deshaun Watson's growing list of misdemeanors becomes ever more sinister by the day. The Browns quarterback, who signed a five-year, $230 million contract only a month ago, has had multiple allegations of sexual assault held against him. The latest one coming from a physical therapist who claimed he got into a happy baby yoga pose and asked the therapist to massage his testicles and anus. And if you haven't seen this, lads, just quickly search happy baby yoga in Google and you'll see what pose Deshaun Watson was getting in. And he was asking asking the therapists to rub his phallus. But it never rains, but it pours for Deshaun Watson. I shouldn't really be laughing, but it's not funny at all. But surely Surely the mounting evidence is going to force the NFL into action. What do you think?
Deshaun! Stop that, Deshaun! What's his problem, man? The testicles and anus detail. It's so such a sterile description of what I'm sure was quite an intimate offence.
Like, did he say, can you please rub my testicles and anus, please?
Apparently so.
Sign this.
Yeah.
Or is sign it like this, my balls or my ass crack?
I mean, when you get in that happy baby yoga pose, like, I'm not sure really what else there is that he needs. Do you know what I mean? But either way, it's just like, how on earth did the organization, Cleveland Browns, think that they said, oh, we've done our due diligence on him. Like, we're quite confident that he's squeaky clean. He's got like 67 different like women coming out with these claims that he was just basically like saying, oh, yeah, like massage this, massage that. Do you know what I mean? In places that you don't really need massages, isn't it? So he's quite clearly a creep.
I bet he was squeaky clean after that baby yoga pose, mate. Into the crevices in that one.
We've talked about this guy before, haven't we? The last time he did this to a masseuse.
Like, a few times,
Keeps leaving him alone with all these masseuses, man?
Well, that's just say, like, so Houston Texans, the organization that he was at, you know, prior to being released or traded, whatever it was, to probably be traded. And then, you know, so they must have known what was going on, man. Because he was actively seeking women out on Instagram. Like, you know, I don't know, maybe like they're independent masseurs on Instagram for like these massages. And they always happen to be like young women, young, attractive women. So clearly he was on one, isn't it? So if you just wanted a massage and you wanted to get your therapy, you'd go to the same person, wouldn't you? You'd have your massage therapist. You'd go to her or him every single week. And, you know, you get to build that rapport and they know where you you need therapy. But he's going to like a different woman. And like he's seeking him out on Instagram. It's clearly quite sinister and quite malicious, man.
So are the NFL like the new Catholic Church in that they relocate their offenders around a large scale and just keep them in circulation?
And protect them.
Because you're right.
Yeah,
protect them. Yes. Sweep it under the rug.
Absolutely swept, man. NFL haven't done anything about it, man. Like, I don't even know if they've released any statements. I'm sure Tommy will be able to tell us next week, but I'm pretty sure they've done absolutely jack shit about it. And even if they do jack shit about it, it'll probably be like, oh, 6-game ban.
$5,000 fine.
And it's really going to teach him. You know what I mean? He's going to have 6 weeks off, have a holiday, and then he's going to sit on his $230 million contract, come back and play. So I don't know how they're going to approach this, but I feel like they need to come down. They need to start coming down on these players, man. It's bullshit.
Well, from one corrupt organization to another, I found this out a couple of weeks ago, that Michelle Platini and Sepp Blatter are on trial in Switzerland for fraud. I had no idea this was going on. Former FIFA bigwigs. So a little breakdown from the BBC website. Swiss prosecutors claim a 2011 payment of 2 million Swiss francs made by Blatter to Platini, ex-president of European football's governing body UEFA, was unlawful. Both men deny wrongdoing and say the transfer was belated payment to former France captain Platini, 66, for his advisory work for FIFA between 1998 and 2002. The pair were banned from football in 2015 and indicted in November last year. Now, this was from a couple of weeks ago, and they were meant to testify on Wednesday of that week when this was supposed to come out. But the trial was postponed because Blatter said he was having chest pains, playing for extra time, the sly old dog. So the trial is due to conclude on the 22nd of June, which is next week, with a verdict expected on 8th of July. If found guilty, the defendants could be jailed for up to 5 years or, more likely, fined. I can't see these two bigwigs going to jail. I didn't know that they were banned from football and I had no idea they were wrapped up in this kind of activity. Does this come as a surprise to you?
I remember back in the day, would you say 2015? Yeah, I do remember Platini and Sepp Blatter basically being kicked off UEFA for various sort of misdemeanors, probably bigger word than that, in terms of taking bribes and stuff. I wouldn't even be surprised if Qatar, which was probably decided prior to 2015, man, like, you know, that doesn't shock you, is that there being some sort of like backhanders put in so that they can have the tournament. I mean, I don't think there's been any sort of evidence to claim that, but you know, if they've been getting away with it for how long? I don't know how long he was in the job, but it seems like this has been a sort of mode of operation for a long time within UEFA. So you know, it doesn't shock me that they're, and it won't shock me if they don't actually do any jail time for it either, to be honest. But yeah, this is just what, you know, how many times we've spoke about UEFA and sort of you know, them being corrupt, and it's just let's just hope that we're over that hill now, and there's going to be more fairness in terms of like decision making when it comes to tournaments and stuff like that. Because you know, that's all you want, really, isn't it? You just want everyone that votes in for these tournaments, you know, to be held in the same regard. But it's difficult, man. It's difficult when there's money involved and there's corrupt men, and there's politics involved and all this shit.
Do we know what this payment was for? So I see a large transfer was made, but any ideas or any inklings if we don't know?
It didn't say in the article, but I was actually thinking that. Are you not allowed to just bust your mate 2 mil? Like, is that against the rules?
I guess it is, yeah. If it's made through the fucking organisation, most probably. It's not like I'm just like saying, yeah, Jim. And why would you bust anybody £2 million, innit?
Well, I don't know. Maybe, you know, he knows that he murdered someone. I don't know. It's like hush money or something.
Nonces,
isn't it? Yeah, oh, I thought that was implied, but yeah, we'll say it. Nonces, definitely.
Yeah, must be. Absolutely must be.
we'll move to from one kind of somber subject to a fairly drastic one from a few weeks ago. South African boxer Simiso Buthelezi died from injuries sustained in a WBF All-African title fight against compatriot Sifisile Mtangwa. I think that's it, yeah. So Saturday before last, which, again, Tom, the script would have been about two or three weeks ago, Buthelezi in the 10th round had bundled Mtangwa over by the ropes in the final round. As the referee separated them, Buthelezi became separated from what was happening at the time. Like, he tracked the referee into the opposite corner as if he thought the ref was the opponent. But when the ref moved away, Buthelezi swung a left hook at thin air and continued to punch as if his opponent was standing there. The referee saw what was happening and saw that there was something seriously wrong and waved the fight off. Mtangwa, probably unaware of the extent of Buthelezi's condition, he celebrated wildly. It was, by all accounts, a very tough fight. Buthelezi later collapsed and was put into an induced coma. He passed away 3 Tuesdays ago now from a bleed on the brain, which is pretty harrowing stuff. We saw the video circulating in the WhatsApp group. I saw it in several places. And it's no joke, man. Like, I've spoken before about semi-feeling guilty about watching combat sports the older I get. And this was an upsetting example of the potential consequences of getting hit in the head.
Pretty horrendous to see him just fighting the air. Just no idea at all what was happening around him. It was sad to watch. And I also read, Mtangwa, that dude, he's the guy who didn't die. He's getting a lot of pressure from his community as well, calling him a killer and things like that. So it's awful on all sides, man.
It's dark, you know, because you got to think in countries where the infrastructure isn't there, when the finances aren't there, inevitably, there is going to be less attention paid to the health and safety of the fighters. And there could have been a number of issues and a number of factors that contributed to that tragic outcome. I really don't know what the what rules they have regarding making weight, rehydration. Are there medics on site, et cetera, et cetera? I'm not sure what the condition is over there, but obviously, he was in a bad way and he was winning the fight.
Going on about infrastructure, I mean, South Africa is known as, you know, one of the strongest economies in Africa, or at least it was. I don't know so much anymore. Maybe it's like Nigeria or Egypt now, but it just seems like a fairly developed country. What do you think it was? Do you think it's something to do with the weight cutting? Do you think it's a lack of infrastructure? Do they check the gloves properly and these sorts of abouts there? What do you reckon?
If I had to guess, I'd say he had a pre-existing thing going on, whether that was from sparring or from previous fights. And that combined with the weight cut and then taking a hammering in the fight as well, it could have, you know, it's impossible to say, but that kind of combination seems likely to me. But just the fact that he was winning the fight, and at first I thought he kind of pushed Mtangwa over, but then I watched the replay and he did land a right hand just before that. So that'd be given as a knockdown, you know, half the time. And that just made it even more frightening that he wasn't getting beat on in the corner. He was pushing forward. He was throwing punches. And then all of a sudden, he's not there anymore. Something to reflect on in terms of watching combat sports in general. And to be honest with you, I'm glad we've got the Jags news to separate that from the combat sports, from the featured fight section. What the fuck? Why do I insist on renaming sections and calling them by their old names? But let's go for the centerpiece of the entire show. Jag News is back. Go on, Flynn.
It's what we've all been waiting for. The listeners have been there with bated breath, surely, for this week's edition of Jag News. And it's a micro mini Jag News this week. And I'll just jump right into it. First bit this week. The first thing going on with the Jags this week is that the Tampa Bay Buccaneers are currently favored to win all but one game this season. What a team. So they're the favorite even in their biggest games, including those against the Dallas, New Orleans, the Green Bay Packers, Kansas City, and the LA Rams. The one game that the Bucs aren't favored is it's a bit of a surprise in the community. We were surprised to hear this. It's their week 14 matchup against the 49ers in San Francisco. It's currently a pick 'em. You all know what that means, so I won't go into what that means. And then another little surprise one is the odds for the team's week 12 game in Cleveland. They're currently unavailable on DraftKings and other betting sites. It's likely due to the ongoing uncertainty surrounding the Deshaun Watson situation. Regardless, it's fair to imagine that the Bucs would be favourites in that game as well. You know, whether it's Watson or Baker Mayfield and under centre for the Browns. So it's looking pretty good. Like I said last week, I'm seeing Super Bowl rings in our future this season, and this has only solidified my belief. Second bit of Jag news is last week we talked about the Bucs are going to be going to Germany to play against the Seattle Seahawks in like the first NFL game in Germany ever. And they did the pre-sale tickets recently, just a few days ago. Sold out in 2 minutes and 49 seconds. There's some seriously serious Bucs fans around the world. Though, don't worry, Jagomaniacs. Don't worry. In July, the normal tickets will go on sale, so keep an eye out for that. And that's it for this week's Jag News. Just a micro edition, but just remember, everyone, for all the latest exclusive news about the Jacksonville Jaguars, you'll get it right here first.
I'm shocked that tickets lasted 2 minutes, 49 seconds. That's WrestleMania levels. That's pretty impressive, isn't it? To be fair, selling out that quickly in Germany. It doesn't picture me as the type of country that would have that amount of interest, man. NFL is actually massive, isn't it? Despite it being a shit game.
I could be wrong. Tommy Howers will be able to tell us next week, but I could be wrong. I think they have the most competitive league outside of the NFL. So,
really?
I think they got a pretty competitive league over in Germany. Yeah, yeah. It's like nowhere near the NFL, but in terms of like it being the next closest thing, I think it's the one in Germany. Yeah, yeah, if I remember rightly. Because the one in England's terrible. I've actually been to a game. There was about 20 people there and a dog. Do you know what I mean? So not many Jagomaniacs out in Bedford.
Not many Jagomaniacs.
Sunday afternoon. Yeah, yeah. And it's like the Bedford
teams.
The Bedford Boat Hawks versus the, I don't know, Milton Keynes.
Cheesemongers.
Yeah, yeah.
The Scunthorpe Shite Hawks.
Yeah. What's the Birmingham one called? There's a Birmingham NFL.
Bullets of basketball. Bullets of basketball.
When you go to Birmingham Bulls, they're the basketball team, aren't they?
No, I thought they're Bullets, aren't they? Birmingham Iron, that was it. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Birmingham Iron.
That's terrible.
No. That's in Birmingham, Alabama.
Oh, even worse.
I don't even know if we've got one. Now we have, because I remember, yeah, I remember Stallions, I think. It might be Stallions, Birmingham Stallions.
That's almost as bad as Iron.
I don't know if you, do you guys ever remember Tyrone Johnston? He I think he plays for them. Dude from Birmingham. He was friends with, like, shout out,
Tyrone, friends with Chidge
and Slimes and all those. I'm pretty sure he plays for them.
Mad. Shows you they just accept any kind of athlete, innit? Tyrone, I don't actually remember him, Tyrone Johnson. No, because I'm sure I've seen on Facebook, like, a few people that, like, from school, and I think they might have been, like, dabbling in it, do you know what I mean? But I think pretty much anybody that with any kind of athletic ability can turn up and, like, try and get on the team, I think. I think, it, like, that's how low the standard is over here.
I could probably play, innit? Give me, like, 6 months.
Yeah, 100%.
Pair of baggy shorts, high tops. Now, you know what? I used to be decent when I was in, like, year seven at school. But last time I tried to throw a basketball in the hoop, it just didn't work. I don't know what was going on.
No, it's solid. I tried recently. It's actually solid. The basketball's solid. NFL will be all right, though, man. Because, like, you just don't really need to do anything. Just push some geezer in it.
Yeah, sumo wrestling style. Shout out to Tanahara.
Just be a linebacker. You're fine. And then just get to the quarterback.
I don't know, man. It's complicated, isn't it, man? It's probably not worth understanding. You know, NFL generally...
It's just not worth getting your head around, is it?
No, that's
not a good endorsement for the Jagomaniacs. So we'll move on to the fights.
Oh man, I have to elevate my NFL hatred. I'm actually just lukewarm on it. I don't care either way, but it's good to take the piss on
you
it.
You don't hate it as much as Flynn hates horse racing.
Oh, fuck horse racing. And you know what? It's not even like an animal welfare issue. It's just. It's what Jim said in our 50th episode. You said something like, but does the horse actually, like, know what it's done? That's why I hate it. It just don't even know what they're doing.
Nah, they do, man. I reckon they do.
So just our best win this or I'll get shot.
Extra fucking pail of seeds or whatever at the end of the day. That's when they know.
And it's like, just won the Kentucky Derby. Smashing it. So they ain't got a fucking clue what they've done, man. So I don't want to become a glue pot. So I better make it over this next hedge before I snap my amazingly thin ankles on this course. How do they? It doesn't make any sense. Anyway, yeah. So on to the featured fights. And the retrospective will begin with a rather quiet week. Last Saturday night, London heavyweight. I've just put London heavyweight there. And Daniel Dubois' name didn't jump immediately to mind. So that was good. But he travelled, London heavyweight Daniel Dubois travelled all the way to the High Lie in Miami, Florida. The drabbest boxing venue I've seen in a long time. It was one of those weird little casinos. It had green painted walls. And it just looked like, it looked like a level in Gears of War or something. Absolutely shocking. So, Daniel Dubois made the journey over there, but he managed to knock out Trevor Bryan in four rounds to become the new WBA regular heavyweight champion. Now, more amazing than that was the fact that this was a Don King show, but only in America. Gray hair, frazzled, that guy. He's 90 years old now. It's amazing what half a century of larceny can do for your vitality. It's just incredible stuff, you know. Robbing fighters of hundreds of millions. You know, stretching back to the time of the Vietnam War. It's great for your complexion, for the pathways in your brain, for your general sense of well-being. But so, even though King's...
So Don King, I haven't heard that name in ages. Has he taken a break from promotion and he's come back, or has he been doing it the whole time?
No, I think fighters finally got wise to the fact that he's just a crook. Finally. I don't know how he managed to maintain that stranglehold over professional boxing for so long. It's like you go to Don King, you get robbed. Next week, world champion signs with Don King. Oh, what the... He's the kind of guy that... I think he did this to Muhammad Ali once. He promised him a set amount for a fight and it was a couple of million. And then like a week before the fight, he turns up with a new contract and a briefcase filled with $250,000. And then he's like, right, you can have the $3 million if you want, or you can have this 250 bang in your hand now, shake on it. And Muhammad Ali was like, yeah, all right, because he needed the liquidity. He needed the cash because he had like a bad financial situation. And he would get fighters in situations like that all the time and just pinch him and squeeze him. Horrible guy. And I can't believe that in this day and age, 90 years old, he had a major belt holder in Trevor Bryan. But that's gone now. He was the last champion in a crumbling stable. Beforehand, I thought there was a whiff of David Price versus Tony Thompson about this fight. Boxing fans will remember David Price back in the day. He was knocking out everyone. And then they pushed him a little bit too quick and matched him against Tony Thompson, who was a two-time championship challenger to Vladimir Klitschko. Got knocked out both times, but he was a veteran and he was a crafty, strong, tough fighter. And he beat David Price twice and he never recovered from that. His confidence never recovered. And I thought Trevor Bryan might be able to do something similar to Daniel Dubois, but this was a one-sided contest. And Dubois, for me, he picked some nice shots, especially with the left hook that finished the fight. But Bryan was unambitious and ultimately outmatched. So now, Daniel Dubois, 18 months and two wins removed from a stoppage loss and a fractured eye socket, is now in the conversation for a proper heavyweight title fight. And this highlights the importance of having a good promoter that's going to back you all the way. Frank Warren has pulled an absolute blinder here. He sent his man abroad for a lesser world title belt that mandates that he face either AJ or Usyk after their rematch. Masterstroke.
That's a mad chess move, that is, isn't absolutely it? That is nuts, man. Yeah. Fair play. That is a fucking really smart thing to do, man.
He's in the same kind of boat as Don King. And they're like, them two were mates like back in the 90s. Two crooks to the end. So it's worked out really well. And Daniel Dubois, 24 years old, probably not like, I don't think he's anywhere near the top level, but commercially and in people's minds, it elevates him to that level. Do you know what I mean? It's very, very clever stuff. But that scenario, it just highlights how funny of a world boxing can be, because where's Joe Joyce, the man who beat Dubois in 2020? He hasn't fought in nearly a year. He hasn't got an opponent for his fight in July. And nobody in their right mind would voluntarily give him a shot at their title. He's signed to Frank Warren as well. So because Frank Warren sees more of an upside in Dubois because he's younger. But in that case, surely he'd prioritise Joyce, who at 36 needs to be fast-tracked. But I don't think people are that interested in seeing Joe Joyce fight for whatever reason. And I think he'd give any heavyweight in the world a really hard night. But Frank Warren knows what he's doing. I just think Joe Joyce is being wasted at the minute, especially after that win. He decimated Dubois, like made him look like he didn't belong in the same ring. So it's one of those. But we'll move over to a more significant and more entertaining event from last weekend. The main card at UFC 275 captivated on a number of levels. And I'll back this over to you two. Did you guys see the main card? I'll start with you, Bissett, because you highlighted earlier that you did.
Yeah. Pretty much sat down and watched it all with the missus. There was a couple of, on the prelims, there was a couple of really interesting knockouts as well. I think there was a Chinese guy that had a really nice knockout, like a right hook, absolutely clean this guy out. I think that might have been in the first round. And then obviously going on to the main card, Zhang Weili against Joanna Jędrzejczyk. I think we thought it was going to be that war from that was in the first fight. It didn't quite manage to get there. I think it was well on its way, wasn't it, from the first round? But I think Zhang Weili probably had the better exchanges. And then it was that incredible spinning back fist. Something that, you know, that inventiveness I haven't seen from Zhang Weili before. So I think that was really, really promising to see her like be in a situation where she could use that sort of creativity to manage to get a finish. That's nice to see. It's part of a game that hopefully she's managed to develop since those two like back-to-back losses against Rose, where she looked a bit flaccid, really. Do you know what I mean? She didn't quite have that sort of that energetic striking ability and that pressure and that mountain sort of like, you know, being able to get in your face and really cause problems. We didn't see that against Rose, obviously, with the first fight with that sort of shock knockout. And then the second fight, which was just a drab affair, which kind of like, right, we kind of saw that was how Rose sort of plays her title defenses, as we saw against Carlos Esparza when Carlos Esparza took a title. But I mean, me and you were speaking about it earlier. I think it's good that Carla Esparza managed to take that title off Rose, because now Janguelli surely in that position, ready to go and take that title back.
Yeah, I think the reason you didn't see that high velocity approach against Rose from Janguelli is I think Rose just took that possibility off the table with a movement and a feint. And sorry, my dog is just like spazzing out on the floor. Yeah, with her movements and her feints and her reach and her kicking ability, Janguelli couldn't just walk in there and like just throw bombs like she did against Joanna in that first fight. And like she was starting to do in this fight. But I agree with you that Janguelli showed, I've seen her throw like the side kick more often than I've seen her do that in the past. And it was her throwing that led to the spinning back fist, because she missed with the side kick. And as soon as her foot touched down, she was already spinning and she connected with the forearm, and Joanna just went face first down on the canvas. And I think that was a great stoppage from the ref. And it's just like, it was an example of how much Janguelli has moved on since their first fight, whereas Joanna Jędrzejczyk hasn't fought in the better part of 2 years. So, Janguelli had everything on her side, power, activity, probably youth a little bit as well. And, I think that the Carla Esparza-Janguelli fight is very appealing to the UFC because it's a matchup we haven't seen before. And I would heavily favour Janguelli in that fight because she won't be reticent or hesitant to take the fight to any area. So, and I don't think Carla Esparza can deal with those smoky hands, to be honest with you.
Yeah, that's what she said, didn't she? She said, like, we're not going to do it in Asia. We won't do it in America. We'll do it anywhere. Do you know what I mean? Let's do it in a neutral place. Do you know what I mean? So I think, yeah, obviously, Janguelli wants it. I know Carla Esparza's come out and said, like, all right, hold up. I've got the title here. We'll do things on my terms kind of thing, which is a bit of a weird thing to say, I think, because she should just be saying, because it's quite clear that's going to be the next, like, who else would you put in there against Carla Esparza? Who else deserves that shot?
We could look at the rankings, but immediately it's like, well, you're looking at Rose, aren't you, for the rematch, but no one wants to see that. Nah, I don't want to see that.
And, like, and I think, from a promotional perspective, like, it's not going to work, is it?
Yeah, look, because of a championship reign and the performances before that Esparza fight, I think she deserves a rematch, but I don't want to see her in a rematch.
You're completely right. Rose definitely deserves it, but Dane is not letting that happen after that last fight. It was panned everywhere as like the worst title fight in history. I can't see it happening again.
And then that leaves Janguelli. What's the name? Andrade. She's still fighting. Michelle Waterson still knocking about. It's not the deepest of divisions, really. No. But that's why the fresh matchup matters. And then I would be fairly confident in predicting Janguelli to be a two-time champ after that. But you never know, man. It's impossible to predict. And the co-main event is the unpredictability of the UFC once more exemplified by Valentina Shevchenko in the co-main event, defending her flyweight title against Talia Santos by razor-thin split decision. Now, I'll pass this over. Thoughts on the fight, if you guys have seen it? How did you see this shaping up? Fair decision, unfair decision?
I don't want to say dominated the first two rounds, but Talia Santos really caused a lot of problems for Shevchenko. Didn't really allow her to get into any kind of flow at all. And if it wasn't for, the headbutt or, you know, the clash of heads that caused Talia's eye to almost completely go shut. And I think she had a broken orbital bone, I think it was, that diagnosed as afterwards. I think she 100% would have won. I think Valentina only really sort of cemented those last two rounds is because of that issue. I still think even with Shevchenko winning the last two rounds, I think a lot of people had Talia Santos winning the first three. I just think she completely eliminated Shevchenko's kind of like attacking prowess, I thought, throughout the fight. I think Shevchenko was a little bit naive, really, trying to go into the grappling exchanges as much as she did. I don't think she expected Santos to be strong in that department, as strong as she was in that department. And I don't think they really adjusted for it, like tactically, her or the coaches. So I still think that, you know, after watching it, even with that unfortunate sort of clash of heads, I still think that Talia should have got the decision. But yeah, I don't know about you, Jim.
I wouldn't call it naivete. It was actually something that I really appreciated about Valentina Shevchenko's performance is that she spent prolonged periods with Santos on her back, threatening the choke, controlling the situations, reversing grappling situations, but she didn't allow herself to become hesitant in looking for the techniques that were available to her. When her head and arm throw became available, she threw it. All right, she might get reversed. When a takedown's available for her, she goes for it. She didn't allow Santos to get the mental, the emotional upper hand. Now, I don't think it worked out to her advantage, but I think that was an honourable way to pursue the fight, you know, to stick to your own game plan, come what may. And I hadn't seen much of Santos before this fight, but in the first round where she first took Shevchenko's back, I saw the way she controlled her upper body and scuttled her hips up so she could get the full body lock on. And I was like, shit, she looks like pretty smooth in this situation. And she stayed composed. And it was only Shevchenko landing punches behind her own head that at times saved her. She was getting controlled for like 2, 3, 4 minutes at a time. I think Santos definitely won the first and the third rounds. I think the fifth round is the only one I would be comfortable in giving to Shevchenko. 2 and 4 up for grabs for me. I wouldn't call it a robbery, but I would compare this fight to Aljamain Sterling and Peter Yan, the rematch. And I think if Aljamain Sterling won that fight, I think Ribas is in with a good shout. Not Ribas, Santos. I keep confusing them. If Sterling is awarded that fight, I think Santos possibly should have been awarded this fight, man.
And I think the 49-46 from one of the judges was particularly egregious. I don't know how you can give 4 rounds to Shevchenko. Like, I just can't understand that at all. I don't know. I've read somewhere that that rather than sort of like ground control time, they wanted to put the onus on like striking, and I can't remember what it was.
But Shevchenko didn't even dominate. She didn't even dominate the striking exchanges. There was a point in the first round where Santos pushed forward and Shevchenko landed a lightning fast right hook. And I was thinking, all right, this is business as usual. But Santos, she's not only good and composed and had decent kicks and was willing to rush in with punches. She was also, for me, a lot bigger than Shevchenko. A lot bigger. I seen her frame and her back and I was like, whoa, she could like be in the weight class above, really. So that was another factor in the fight. And you're right in that the headbutt was the only real damage that Santos sustained, which is some feat, really, when you're talking about Shevchenko. But we'll move on to the fight we can all talk about while I'm getting blinded by this sun. All right, you off then, Bishop.
Yeah, I've got to shoot to my sessions. But yeah, you guys finish up the feature fights and we'll see you next week.
All right, in a bit. Take care, man. Easy. Enjoy the session.
See you later, lads. Thank you. Bye-bye.
See you, bud. All right. Wrestling talk, yeah?
Yeah, finally.
But yeah, welcome to the real Bull Chat Sports podcast, everyone.
Yeah, Flynn was laying in the cut for a good 45 minutes there, just waiting. So yeah, you saw the highlights from the main event, didn't you? So what did you make of it? What sense of the fight did you get from him? Because I haven't actually watched the highlights yet. And I can't imagine they managed to tell the real story of the fight.
It looked wild in the highlights. I've read a lot about it after. And yeah, maybe the highlights didn't do it justice, but it looked wild. Like, it was like what? It was a stand-up striking kind of game for a lot of it. But then Glover just kept like absorbing huge, huge shots. And it just looked like it didn't affect him at all, which... In the post-fight scrum, he did say, yeah, they hurt a lot. But he just didn't show it. And then I think, what's the other dude called? Yuri
Prochazka, Yuri, I think.
Yuri, yeah, right. Imagine being him, smashing Glover as hard as he can again and again in the ribs and everywhere. And he's just keeps coming at you. And then that shock ending. What was that about?
Mate, I was watching and it had been like a real seesaw back and forth. One of the most competitive fights I've seen in ages. It wasn't the cleanest fight, should I say. Like, the techniques that were being landed weren't the cleanest. But like,
I like them, though. It was a scrap.
It was a proper scrap. And
yeah,
with both men trying to implement very specific game plans, like Glover, he was trying to do the Jan Blachowicz, just take him down, beat him up, sub him. That was his game plan. He came in there with his dad bod hanging over his shorts and just looking like the guy who's about to get beat up. Because Jiří Procházka is a huge human being. He's massive. He's like 6'5" or something. And I remember watching him in one of the promotional embedded, the UFC embedded. And he was standing there with his fists clenched. And his fists were like rocks, like boulders on the end of his arms. And I was thinking, this is not a good night for Glover. I honestly thought he was going to fuck him up bad, like first round or two over. But Glover Teixeira has taken something out of becoming champion after such a long professional career. And he wasn't going away easy. Jiří Procházka landed early and he landed hard and he kept coming forward and he kept looking for single leg takedowns and he kept initiating ground and pound situations and then looking for submission attempts. Jiří would somehow get out back on the feet and the same pattern would take hold. You know, it was fascinating to watch, man.
What's Yuri's background? Is he more of a striker?
I would say so. He looks like he's got some kind of Thai, Muay Thai influence, but it's a very strange, herky-jerky, kind of hands-down style. Like in this fight, he spent a lot of the time feinting and probing and touching, but in a very awkward kind of rhythm. I felt like he had the most success when he threw really straight punches, because that's when you're seeing his reach really come into play. And you could see that he was shaking Glover with a lot of the shots that he was landing. But then, as I say, Glover would get the takedown and drag him down and land elbows and all that kind of stuff. And it was, I think they got to the point in the second or third round where they were both becoming comfortable with each other's power. And they were absorbing things that earlier were shaking them. And then they just started walking through them. And in the fourth round in particular, I remember thinking in one of the positions when they were on the floor that, oh, this is definitely, definitely going the distance, man. There was a point in the third where Glover really hurt Jiří Procházka and the stand-up. He had him knocked out on his feet and then he jumped to a guillotine and then he slipped off. Like it was a moment where he could have won the fight, but it was just the instinct had taken over. You know, it was one of those really primal performances. And the last thing I expected was for Jiří Procházka to wrap this massive arm around Glover Teixeira's neck and to tap him in the fifth round. That was the last thing.
Outrageous. Was it rear naked?
Yeah, but it wasn't the cleanest thing. It was like durability, strength and size ultimately won out in that contest. And it's a sad thing to see, but I'm trying not to dress this up as something else, but I honestly think that was a heroic performance from Glover Teixeira because he did everything in his power to win that fight. He did everything. He didn't leave any stone unturned. There were so many opportunities for him to quit. There were so many opportunities for him to look for a way out. There was a point where he was sitting on his stool and he's going, I'm going to beat this guy. I'm going to beat this guy. I'm like getting goosebumps watching it on a Sunday morning. And I'm thinking, he's going to beat this guy. He's going to break him. But fair play to Jiří Procházka. He showed on the biggest stage of his entire career that he doesn't wilt under the pressure. And that is a key ingredient to being a champion. And what's mad about him is I don't think he's anywhere near as good as he could be. Like, think about this. He's got similar dimensions to John Jones. He's probably even bigger and he's probably even longer and he's more muscular and he's got more power. But he fights in a way where he gives up all his physical advantages. It's so mad. If he learned how to fight tall, I don't know if he can do that at this stage in your career. I think he's like 27 or 28. Retraining on that level might be problematic. But if he was able to sit behind that jab, just that jab, like good luck getting past that, man. Good luck getting past that. Like a front kick and a jab and takedown defense. Good luck.
Speaking, just to go back to about you saying Glover looked like a champ, that's something I've been hearing quite a bit. This was his first defense, wasn't it, since he won that title? He won it quite a while ago when Khamzat fought the Leech way back then.
Yeah.
Is this his first defense since then?
Yeah, yeah.
And I know a lot of people say, you know, it's all about getting that title and then defending it against top-level dudes. But what I'm hearing and what I saw in those highlights was a champion going, just go into war with it. I give him a load of respect. I got goosebumps when I saw him win that belt at 41 yeah. years old.
Yeah, man.
And I need to watch this full fight now.
I'm mentioning his dad bod. That was probably the worst condition I've seen Glover Teixeira in. I saw it straight away. I thought, bro, he looks really pudgy around the middle. I know he's a bit older, but usually he comes in better shape than that. And after the fight, he said he had a really bad weight cut. And this is completely plausible. I mean, we've talked loads of times about the weight cutting process and how specific it is. And if you misjudge it, there's so many things that can affect it. It's easily misjudged. And they were fighting in Singapore as well, not too far from Abu Dhabi where he won the title. But there's a load of things that can cause your body to retain water, etc. So if he did have a really bad weight cut and he was still able to go five horrendous rounds against the bigger, stronger, younger guy, then I actually like his chances in the rematch. But at the same time, for a similar reason that I was happy that Zhang Weili and Joanna Jędrzejczyk didn't go to war again, I'm not sure if I want to see Glover Teixeira put himself through that kind of thing again, right at the end of his career, because I would favour Jiří in that rematch. Like, I thought he was going to win this, but not in the manner. I didn't see that back and forth and that kind of attrition.
Are you happy for this to be Glover's swan song? He doesn't need any more beatings. He won the belt late in the career. He's lost it in a heroic way. So farewell kind of thing.
Yeah, but I think he'll probably do the rematch. I think, like, I was watching one of those BT Sports about UFC, and they were saying that Glover had this fight in mind and then a show in Brazil at the end of the year penciled in as his last fight. So if they do the rematch in Brazil for his final fight, I think that would be a perfect way to sign off. But maybe don't take as many shots this time, because that was rough. That was rough in there at times. But yeah, I kind of hope he leaves it, but I wouldn't want to have such a galling loss as the sign off, because that is, he was so close, man. I think he was winning that fight. Yeah, that would be keeping him awake at night, man. But we've only got one fight for the look ahead. This Saturday at Madison Square Garden, Artur Beterbiev and Joe Smith Jr. will put their respective light heavyweight titles on the line, with the winner set to grab three quarters of the Undisputed Championship. Both of them are massive punchers. Beterbiev is undefeated in 17 and has never gone the distance. He's knocked out everyone he's fought. He's a brutal, brutal power puncher. He's very aggressive. He's got a solid chin and outstanding amateur credentials. He went 96-10 in the vest and head guard. So think a more reckless Gennady Golovkin as a point of reference. Joe Smith Jr. is 28-3 with 22 knockouts. He was stopped once early on in his career, but has only lost since to the masterful Dmitry Bivol and a prime Sullivan Barrera, both durable, tricky boxers. But Smith, to his credit, has learned and developed from those losses. He won the vacant title against Maxim Vlasov in an absolute war. He boxed circles around Steve Geffrard in his first defense. He's got a long reach. He punches well to the body, and he's got a beast of a right hand. And I actually feel like he's in his prime right now. On the other hand, Beterbiev is 37 years old, although his performances haven't dropped yet. As I mentioned earlier, he does have a good chin, but the only reason I know that is because he gets hit quite a lot. When you fight that aggressively, that's definitely going to happen. But I don't think he's been in with the caliber of puncher that Smith is. Beterbiev's usual way could be risking this fight, but I think he'd be much stronger on the inside than Smith, so the risk might be worth the reward. And I wonder, with Smith's reach, whether a more cautious, amateurish approach wouldn't just give rounds away and ultimately lead to him being more aggressive later on and perhaps a little bit more reckless. So I think he needs to get inside and do it quick. And weirdly, though, the Gvozdik fight aside, which was another war, I've never really enjoyed watching Beterbiev. I don't know why. I know he's an elite fighter, but for some reason, I hold back when it comes to seeing him fight. Like, maybe it's an aesthetic thing, but I just don't get excited. I don't know. He looks a bit awkward, ungainly. His timing's a bit weird. He just seems brute force, but I know he's got a lot of technique underneath it. There's just something about him. It's just missing. He's missing some kind of crucial component. But this fight is different because I do enjoy watching Smith. And I think style-wise, this can't be a boring fight. As for the result, I think Beterbiev will break him down. I was trying to convince myself otherwise, but I can see him squashing Smith's jab and just landing bombs on the inside.
A UFC coming up, a big one.
Is that this weekend?
Or is it the next one?
I'll have a quick look now. Yeah, I did see this. I probably should have included it, but I wasn't too inspired. Calvin Kattar versus Josh Emmett. Chikadze last time out, didn't he? Proper fucked him up. That Georgian geezer, who is quite a big knockout artist. And then Kattar just put it on him, like bust him up.
I don't know if I caught this.
Yeah, it was decent. The highlights are well worth a watch. I see that we've got Donald Cerrone versus Joe Lauzon.
And, boy Cerrone.
Yeah, what is this, man? 2006, Cerrone versus Lauzon. Oh my God, take off the Venom shorts, man. Let's get the fucking Manscaping sponsors back on the board shorts. Killing it. And Kevin Holland versus Tim Means. Kevin Holland, man, he's a weird one, isn't he? I wonder if he's learned to wrestle yet instead of just speaking to people while he's getting dominated on the ground.
Is that what he does? He talks shit while he's getting dominated.
Yeah, they call him Big Mouth, apparently. And he lost to Derek Brunson. And he lost to someone else as well. And he was like talking to Khabib or Daniel Cormier, cage side, going, teach me how to wrestle. And I was thinking, what a div, man. But it turns out he's been doing this his whole career. Like, he appeared on the Contender Series and Dana White was going to give him a contract. But he was like, oh, he's a good fighter, but he just won't shut the fuck up, Bennett. And then Kevin Holland ended up fighting for the UFC as a late replacement. And that's how he got through the door, isn't it? But he's recently moved down to welterweight. So I think his height, his length will be really advantageous down there, 170. So we'll see, man. We'll see. But that is everything. Because one aren't back for another month or so. And then Bellator about the same. I haven't been watching the PFL lately. I think Rory McDonald's fighting Ray Cooper IV in a rematch coming up sometime soon. But nothing too exciting for me, to be fair, man. You looking forward to anything?
Well, next Mr. Olympia's not till December, so my schedule's wide open.
Yeah, to be fair, it's going to be hard to break to Bishop that we can't watch the England game because the Olympia's on.
Because we're flying him to Las Vegas to watch it live.
Yeah, yeah. Now, don't be mad, Bishop. We've booked you a flight. Vegas, baby! You'd be like, whoa, what we do, man? Yeah, we're going to go watch the Olympia? You'd be like, fuck you guys, man. That would be the most expensive but worthwhile practical joke ever.
Wedding presents.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Yeah, stag. Woo! Where are we going? The Olympia. Maybe you could get a day pass for like 40 quid or something. Because I would love to do it at WrestleMania, but good luck getting tickets to WrestleMania, man. Sitting right at the back. 6-hour show. Vince McMahon. No chance.
You got no chance. It went off the last WrestleMania. Stone Cold come and fought a fight. The Rock opened the show. It went right off.
The best one, Shane McMahon. It's like, here comes the money. Dollar, dollar, yo. Here comes the money. Love that one.
No chance.
You're fired. Remember the Kiss My Ass Club? Remember that shit?
I remember the Kiss My Ass Club. Actually, Go Bars, Kiss My Ass Club.
he made his employees kiss his ass on TV. If that's not some fucking weird Maxwell conspiracy shit, I don't know what it is, man. He was in Epstein's black book, wasn't he? McMahon.
Oh, for sure he was, definitely, man.
He owned
for
the island, 100%. 100%, man. But is there anything else, any Jags news you got coming up? Or should we wrap it up right there, Flynn?
No big... The season's not starting for another month. I think it's August. The NFL kicks back off, if I'm not wrong. So it's a while until the Jag news really hots up. But I'll keep one eye on the latest comings and goings anyway. Yeah.
Keep your tail up in the air, mate. Jags news. All the
transfer rumours and all that sort of thing. Draft picks, you know.
All right, then. We'll wrap it up there. Thank you for joining us after your bike ride, Flynn. That's dedication to the end, mate. And I will see you next week, man.
See you next week. All right. Good night, everybody.